for me today, personally, being a Rom is being a part of community which should be at the lead of what society of tomorrow should be in terms of what diversity is, in terms of what acceptance of diversity is, in terms of how much I am defined by myself and how much I'm defined by the others, the way they look at me.
Romatopia. Romata e sintura qeren svato katrlenji utopia. Sarbishaja e Evropa tharate avel.
Hello, Lachu Divas, and welcome again to our next episode of the podcast Romatopia. Roma talk about their utopia for Europe. It is us again. My name is Isabel Rabe, and I'm hosting this podcast together with William Bieler.
And a big welcome to everyone also from my side.
In this podcast, we are going to talk to Roma from all over Europe and beyond about their lives, about their experiences, and about their utopia. We want to present counter images and counter narratives to oppose stereotypes and prejudices.
In the coming months, we'll be talking to a number of noteworthy community members from a varied cross-section of the Romani peoples. I'm really interested in hearing about what being Romani is to other people, because we don't often get a chance to discuss such things.
For those who do not know, the Romani peoples are Europe's largest minority. This includes Sinti, Roma, Gitanos, Romanis, and other groups who loosely share a common ancestry and have been present in Europe for well over 600 years. Through linguistic theories, we know they originated in India, traveled through Persia, and were present in the Eastern Roman Empire for some time before dispersing throughout Europe. Their economic and cultural contributions have historically been overlooked. Their history is an integrally interwoven part of European history, which also is often mistaken as one of external exclusion and hardship. Though periods of extreme persecution did make their mark well before the 20th century and the genocide which we suffered during the Second World War. After the fall of the Iron Curtain in 1989, Romani peoples have gradually been making themselves more visible on the European scene. Let's welcome our today's guest, Saimir Mile.
Good morning, Saimir.
Hello, good morning.
So Saimir, we have a little game that we usually start off the interview with. And so we have someone who described you in one sentence, and you have to guess who said this. So here we go.
Yeah.
He's a great linguist and one of the bravest activists I know. He never compromises the Romani issue. The Mecca Roma from Mizekeia are always brilliant in what they do, thanks to Saimir.
I am almost sure this is Sead Kazanciu.
Exactly.
Yes. I guess he made it obvious. Yes, you guessed correctly. I guess, I don't know if we make this game too easy for everybody or not.
Until you pronounced Mizekeia, I was thinking about Željko Jovanović, but with a Mizekeia, I guessed because we are from the same region.
Yes, there you go. Well, it was sad. Great.
And Saimir, when you should describe yourself in one sentence, how would you describe yourself?
Well, I am a man in the movement. A man in the movement. Not so much in physical movement, especially these times, but someone who evolves and who goes on and tries to get every day a bit better than the day before.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, and we were going to talk about the movement you're in later when we talk about your work. For that our listeners get to know you a bit better, I'm going to read a short CV. Saimir Mile is a Rom, originally from Albania, but living in France for well over 20 years. He studied in France and completed 3 master's degrees. First, master's in international law at Université Paris 1, La Sorbonne. Second, master's in EU construction at the Université de Paris 8. And third, master's professional action et solidarité internationale from the Institut Catholique de Paris. He's a linguist and expert in the Romani language, worked as an instructor in INALCO, the prestigious National Research Institute and Language School in Paris, under the guidance of Professor Marcel Courtiade, and himself has extensive knowledge of Roma history. Along with his classmates, he founded the association La Voix des Roms in 2005. Within this association, he's now heading the legal department of a national syndicate of Roma civil society activists, which is called the Movement of May 16th, in honor of those who acted to stand up for themselves in 1944 in Auschwitz as a way to keep their memory alive and inspire others to action in their daily lives. In his roles within the association, he has also initiated academic research into the history of the uprising of Sinti and Roma, in addition to supporting resistance movements of allies, including Muslims, people of African descent, and Asians, towards the recognition of universal human rights. Impressive biography, Saimir. Does this sound correct, or is there anything you want to add?
Well, it is quite correct. I'm always amazed by the importance that takes my linguistic background as compared to the legal background. But this is because of the activists, of my friends, actually, who always see this part, which is not more important, but less common among the Romani activists in Europe. Yeah,
that might be the reason. Yeah,
I think that's exactly it. It's a rare thing, so it has to be noticed. Yeah.
We are a plethora of lawyers, but not so many of us are linguists.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
People focus on that part. Yeah.
And we're gonna talk about you being linguist and about the Romani language later. But let's first start to get a bit into your childhood. We are interested in how you grew up. And here's my first question. What is your most vivid memory of your childhood?
Oh, there are many of them. The games that I played with my cousins, with my brother also, but also the school, the way that I, all those days of school. I wouldn't say that I was a very a hard worker in school, but it was fun.
So, and what were your favorite games?
In those times, we used to fabric ourselves, to make ourselves our games. I mean, with pieces of wood, of some plants, stuff like this. We used to make some kind of mobile things, which we pretended they were cars. Well, they were not cars, of course, but with some wood and some steers and stuff, we played with them. We were very creative in that time, actually, because there were no all made games in the market. Mm-hmm. It was something very rare. It was not a question of money, it was a question of disponibility, availability. There were no such things. We had to think a lot.
Ah, so you've been using your imagination ever since.
Exactly.
That's where it comes from.
So, yeah.
Can you tell our listeners, where did you grow up exactly? How was it?
I grew up in the house I am now in, because I came here for the New Year to my parents in Albania. It's a small town called Patos. It is an area in which there is oil, and there is exploitation of oil here. My mother used to work in a state enterprise of oil exploitation. My brother now works in such an enterprise, which is a private one. So here is where I grew up. It is a really small city, about 20 to 25,000 inhabitants. And in that time, it was even smaller, made of different people coming from different areas of Albania. It is a new city, which was founded in 1946. as they found that there was oil to be exploited here. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of diversity of ethnic diversity. I wouldn't say so, but yeah, regional diversity here. Mm-hmm. And we were just two, then three Romani families, and there are only two now.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us when you first discovered you were Roma? I know you told me a story once, but do you want to share that with us now?
Yeah, it was here in this city. We were playing outside in the street. It was not dangerous in that time because there was maybe one car which passed by in a week. So we were playing with friends here, and some Romani people passed by, and the children here had in that time some kind of songs or slams and about the gypsies that we called here Arigi, and they went behind them singing those songs, which in English would be whether it rains or is a sunny day, the gypsies, the Arigis go around or something mm-hmm. like that. And I was singing the same with my mates from my quarter, from my street. And my older sister called me in, and I came in, and she said, "You shouldn't do that." I said, "Why?" "Because you are one of them too." And I was like, "What are you speaking about? This is not true. It can't be true." So this is how I discovered who I was. And I was in that time, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6.
Okay. And how did you deal with this? What happens then? Did you discuss it with your parents or within the family? Or how did you feel?
Not really. This was not a subject of discussion, actually. Mm-hmm. And no, there was no discussion on it. But when cousins used to come here, for instance, or my aunts or my uncles, and in sometimes I heard my father speaking with them in another language. I remember my great aunt saying to me, when I asked her what's that language, she said, "It is Greek." So slowly, well, of course, I realized that I was a member of that community. And I don't know how to say that. We developed some kind of defensive tools mm-hmm. Because nothing was there to comfort me, for instance, or my brother or my sisters, in this identity which we didn't really have. We didn't speak Romani at home. Mm-hmm. We didn't know much about tradition or stuff. We used to go for the holidays and meet with our families in the village from which Sead comes. Mm-hmm. We come from the same village, and there is an important community. But this was not our daily life, our daily identity. Mm-hmm. It was something that we were in little contact with. We knew about it, and we always had an attitude which consists of saying, "I am proud of being a gypsy," we used to say in that time, which is Arigi here in my region, and that's it, but without really being proud, because we didn't have any concrete thing which could make us proud.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. Yeah, in Slovakia, I've heard people say, like, and my mother, it's instead of calling it Greek, they say Italian. So it happens. Yeah. It happens everywhere. But then, how was it in school? You were just one of two families. Did you experience any kind of discrimination in school or maybe at university? And
No. Really, no. But there was this... I mean, usually I was comfortable in the normal conditions, normal life. it was okay. There were no issues with this. But sometimes this came out from others. And I remember that one of my friends, for instance, told me in a discussion they had with other students of the high school, one girl said, well, what, you know, anyway, he's a gypsy.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And my friend told her, you better shut up your mouth because this is not your problem, what he is. He's my friend and he's a very good guy and that's it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he told me this afterwards. But, you know, it was more of when there were conflicts or when the subject of ethnicity came, I was not feeling comfortable.
It's like it doesn't come up. You don't have to deal with it most of the time. But when it comes up once, all of a sudden it is uncomfortable. And you kind of, well, for me, I think it was similar. If it came up, it was uncomfortable. I didn't know how to react. And because I'm not used to facing that daily kind of discrimination. So I was kind of shocked and just watching for and trying to figure out what to do and always thinking about it afterwards.
Actually, it is because of my social class.
Mm-hmm.
I was and still am, my family is in between the middle and the upper class of the society. So I didn't correspond, and I still don't correspond, to what people think of gypsies, to what people think we are or we should be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this status there, this discrepancy is causes this tension of you don't really know how to react to that. And people don't find it normal, be that in a racistic way or in another way. They cannot imagine. And this is how I have listened so many times, people saying to me, oh, please, don't spoil it. Don't say that you are a gypsy.
Yeah, it's often mixed up. This culture of poverty is seen as Romani culture.
Yeah.
Poverty and all the otherness, actually. It's not just the poverty, but dirtiness. I don't know.
When did you come to France, Saimi, and how did you experience this time after your arrival in France?
Well, in France, it was totally different because I didn't know anyone and no one knew me.
Mm-hmm. So you came here, you came to France all alone?
I came to France as a student, all alone. In any way, it was a new, totally new life, new language, new country.
And did you like it?
I liked it. And I liked it especially because I struggled hard for getting there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was in 96. And it was really difficult to get scholarship and a visa to go and to study.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got it, although the hardship, I was very happy. And also, I was really motivated.
So where do you feel at home now?
I don't know, Bill.
Tell us more. You don't know because you don't feel at home anywhere or because you feel at home everywhere?
Until a few years ago, I felt home in France.
Mm-hmm.
Until 2-3 years ago. But I notice now, the last 2 years, when I come here, I don't know, maybe it's the age, the nostalgia, and I feel home here too. So I feel home here, I feel home in France. And it happened to me to feel home in some places that I just discovered.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, that's a good feeling.
Mm.
Yeah, in Andalusia, for instance, I really felt home,
mm-hmm.
although I was there for 3-4 days.
Mm-hmm.
Saimi, when did you become an activist?
I don't really know. I started here before leaving Albania. The civil society didn't exist in Albania until 1990. The regime changed, then the democracy started with the pluralism and so on. So this is the time when the first organizations, free organizations, started. And I was very young at that time, I was 15, and I participated in some activities here, but I couldn't really say that I was an activist. I was a teenager. I had some clue of what was happening with this community that happened to be mine and which I wasn't really in. So I was there a bit, but the real activism, I can say that I started it in France, mm-hmm. actually. Mm-hmm. Since the 1999, let's say, 1999, 2000.
We're going to later talk about the association you co-founded, La Voix des Roms. But before, another question. We're in the middle of a pandemic, and you once said, I quote, racism arises in times of crisis. The problems with minorities reside from the sickness of the majority. What is the situation of Romani people in France at the moment?
Actually, the main problem is the one of who are the Romani people, mm-hmm. of identifying them. Mm-hmm. No one really knows, but everyone feels like he knows enough to speak about.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's a great answer.
So I can't give an answer because I know enough to know that I don't know.
Yeah.
The Romani people is so diverse. I mean, Bill and myself are Romani people in France, but no one, we don't enter in any, no statistics because there is no such a thing, but in any empirical overview or analysis. And we are not exceptions. This is the thing to be understood. Mm-hmm. Bill, myself, a lot of people that we know, we are not exceptions. Mm-hmm. So I cannot say how the pandemic was and what were the consequences on the Romani people there. Mm.
This question, what is the situation of the Roma people in France? It's such a big and general question. I knew that when I saw this, like when we have our script here to ask you these questions, that this is like an impossible question. And I always, you know, I get that question and I don't know how to answer it, but we left it here on purpose for you so that you could do it. And I'm very happy at how you approached it, because I always ask myself too, what do I say to that question? And so please continue.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, actually, I think that France is a model, bad or good or whatever, but it is a model. Maybe it is not, but it is for me, because I know very good how the things, how the categorization is made there. And it is so complex that once you understand this, you can understand perfectly what happens in Hungary, between the Romani people and the Beas people, what happens in Romania or in Bulgaria between the Romani people and the Rudari people, what happens in Kosovo between the Romani people, the Balkan Egyptians or Ashkalian Egyptian people. So
I never thought about it that way. I think that that's very true. I'm always surprised how you can put like a new spin, something creative on something that I also know, but you put a really unique new point of view on it. I really appreciate that.
Thanks. Thanks. It's like you look for the gypsies and you say the Roma. This is the general rule. You are in charge with a study about Romani people, and you look for the gypsies. Unconsciously, you look for the gypsy because all of us, including Romani people, have been educated in this way. All of us have an image of the gypsies. None of us has a clear idea of how the concept of gypsy and the concept of Roma is related. In which way?
Mm. Yes.
They are related. They are related, but they are not equal. They're not the same thing. And no one really says or really knows or really says in which way they are related, because it is very complex and it depends on every regional context. Regional, not even state context. Mm. I mean, the situation is quite the same in Switzerland and in Savoie and in Auvergne in France.
Yeah, we're in the middle of this really complicated and complex discussion of identity politics, aren't we? Like setting a group without trying, for political reasons also, without trying to define something like Romani culture, which doesn't exist. It's rather Romani cultures, the diversity and heterogeneity.
Yeah, this is the thing. And I think that we are too much invested. I don't know your questions, but I know about the Romatopia as also this utopia about Europe. This is very important, actually, because Romani culture or Romani cultures.
Mm.
I think that there are Romani cultures, in plural, which have all some common elements here and there between them. And the question of the diversity, when it comes to Romani people, the question of diversity is put on the table as something that divides people, or at least is felt in this way by many Romani activists who are actually influenced by the uniformism of the mainstream.
I think that sentence you just said is very complex, and I think that we will have a chance to discuss and analyze that further, because the framework of the majority that makes it impossible to understand the diversity or the acceptance of the diversity, or we could, you know, we could look at anthropologists dividing us up into groups and saying, oh, well, this group in Italy calls themselves gypsies, so we should call them gypsies, and this group in this village in Romania calls themselves gypsies and they should be called gypsies, so they don't call themselves Roma, so they're not Roma. But that doesn't mean that we're divided. We can have differences and be, you know, have our local traditions or regional traditions, but that doesn't mean that there's no connection. And this absolute division or absolute one nation, one absolute, or there's something in between that exists that's true that isn't fully examined. And both are true, but there's a paradox.
Actually, let's remember what we learn in school from Einstein: nothing is absolute but the fact that everything is relative. There is no absolute diversity, there is no absolute unity. And this is true for all minorities, as it is true also for all majorities. This is something that, from our historical political experience in the Roman, in what we could call still Romani movement or Romani movements, because there have been many of them, I have learned this. And as it happened that I also learned a bit of the history of France, because this was part of my academic background in law school, also a bit about other processes of nation building, we should be very in peace with this. Peoples are diverse. Of course, they unite and they organize politically, but this uniformity has never existed, does not exist, and will never exist.
And France is a perfect example of that as well, as a model. Well.
Yeah. So, and there is nothing wrong with it. On the contrary, once you accept the reality as it is, then you live more happily with yourself and with the others. There is no reason, all those, you know, the discriminations, the fights against racism and so on. Very recently in our organization, we spoke about, could the anti-racist, anti-gypsist fight, could the fight against anti-gypsism leave aside the identity questions? This is what we did for 2 or 3 years, focusing on anti-gypsism, 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 and still we are still there. But more and more we're feeling that we cannot leave aside the identity issues, not issues, but the identity analysis and addressing.
Yeah,
we have to address the identity and the identities if we want to be efficient in our fight against discrimination and in our fight for a real equality.
That's the perfect link, because we want to talk about the association you co-founded, La Voix des Roms, which means the voice of the Roma. And by the way, Bill, you're the president of this association since 2016, right?
Yes, that's correct. No secret though.
So on the website of La Voix des Roms, it says the specificity of La Voix des Roms' approach consists in seeing racism not only a moral bad mood of the population, but above all and more deeply a historical set of institutional conceptions and practices. Sami, you already talked about the focus of addressing anti-gypsyism and now also taking into consideration identity politics. Maybe you want to tell us a bit more about the work of the association and your approach.
Yeah, when we founded the association in 2005, I was younger and more naive than I am now. Mm-hmm. I still keep some naivety because it's good, but it is conscious now. So in that time, actually, the association was about spreading knowledge about who the Roma are. Mm-hmm. But with the years, and this was also because we thought in that time that spreading such information would make our community more acceptable in the eyes of the majority of institutions and so on. Mm-hmm. After a few years, we realized that this was not true, not at all. Mm-hmm. And in 2010, there has been a real crisis. After the Italy crisis in France, we had a very tough policy decided at the top level of the state with the president of that time, Nicolas Sarkozy, the minister of interior, the police, tax services, and so on. A very repressive policy against Roma and travelers, as they used to say. And in that time started the policy of eviction of illegal settlements of Roma and travelers. There has been a political tension after this between France and the European Commission, which led to some changes, also some policy changes at the European level. Mm. For instance, the European Romani civil society had advocated for years for having a European strategy for Roma inclusion. Yeah. And the European Commission, I still remember the vicious smile of one European Commission employee who said, "Stop dreaming about it. You will never have such a thing." And this was a few months before EU frame for the integration of Romani people in Europe was adopted. Mm. It was adopted because of the tension between Nicolas Sarkozy and the Commissioner on Human Rights. So, anyway, we had in 2010 this really hard repressive policy. And we started acting a bit differently, tackling the racism since then. More and more, we adopted a decolonial approach and putting also the accent on the empowerment of the people. Mm-hmm. And this is where we are now. We have participated also in reflection at the European level with Alliance Against Anti-Gypsyism, with other organizations, scholars, and so on. And we adopted a position of thinkers-players. Mm. Let's say that until 2014, 2015, we were very active on the ground, making protests, stuff with people who were excluded. But after this, we started to think deeply on what are the structural reasons of all these phenomena that we are fighting against. Mm. Yeah, this is the evolution of La Voix des Roms since the beginning. And today we are on both sides, reflection, developing the knowledge about the anti-gypsyism and also keeping the link with the ground in a circular way. We feed the one with the other.
Yeah. Perhaps you could give us some examples of the activities of La Voix des Roms and describe what exactly the association is doing.
Well, in terms of methodology, for instance, since a few years, everyone who is a bit interested on what the Romani organizations are doing in Europe can see that there is more and more focus put on the resistance.
Yeah.
This is a concept that we promoted. We started in 2010 with the first celebration of the what we called in France the L'Insurrection Gitane, and which became then the Romani Resistance Day, which is the 16th of May.
The day, the 16th of May, is used to commemorate the heroism and the courage of the Sinti and Romani people interned in the concentration camp of Auschwitz-Birkenau, who on the 16th of May 1944 resisted, and fought the Nazis that intended to exterminate them. The need to commemorate the bravery and the actions of those who incited this uprising has been seized by many members of the community across Europe since 2012 as an important defining point in taking control of their own people's historical narrative. Rather than passively being referred to as the eternal victims, the event illustrates the power of the Romani peoples once a decision to act collectively is taken. It is also serving as a present-day call to action. Whether or not it took place on the 16th of May or another date is perceived less relevant than actually remembering what happened and acknowledging that they can decide for themselves what is important to them today, just as they did in the darkest hours of May 1944.
In a publication of the West Germany Communist Party, we found an article speaking about this act of resistance in the Zigeuner Familienlager in Birkenau. We found there actually that there was something interesting to address, no anymore the vague population, but to target specifically a subject and specific groups, saying that the memorial activities are not there just for our pleasure or for feeling a bit better or less guilty or I don't know what. These activities are there for saying also to those who suffer discrimination, exclusion today, that their grandparents used to fight and that they should fight too.
Mm-hmm.
So this resistance idea started in Saint-Denis, where our organization is, in 2010, and now it is spread all over. Then we, in my daily work, actually, as a lawyer in La Voix des Hommes, I see people who have different issues with different institutions, for instance, or who are victims of violence. And we have this knowledge from the ground on how what different forms takes the phenomenon of anti-Gypsyism, which feeds our reflection and our advocacy towards the institutions. And in the same time, this feeds our action with those who concretely suffer from discrimination when they are refused such or such right in a city hall or in with the health rights, access to health or to school or whatever. We know more and more how the normal mind is made also of anti-Gypsyism, which place takes the anti-Gypsyism in the mentality of the ordinary people, so that we tackle it in the most efficient way.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the methodology.
Maybe we could talk a little bit more about the 16th of May for our listeners, which is a mixed audience, Roma and non-Roma people listening to us. Maybe we could explain why the 16th of May is so important to the association as Roma Resistance Day, and why is that the central point, you know, the focus for our activities as opposed to August 2nd?
Well, the 16th of May is the day in which the prisoners of the Zigeuner Familienlager refused to get out when the truck came there to pick them and to lead them to the gas chambers. So this is an act of resistance, and it is about empowerment. It is about empowerment, and people need this. People who suffer discrimination need to have some hope, not hope based on I don't know what kind of dream, but hope based on examples. And this is an example in which people resisted in very, in extremely dire conditions. They fought for their lives. They were ready to fight physically with the best armed people in that time, which were the SS who were guarding the camp. So this gives force, and this gives force really concretely to young people today who start action to defend their rights. This is why for us, the 16th of May is more important than the 2nd August, which is an official day of commemoration and so on. But it doesn't reach those who are in need, the most in need, actually, of being protected from the anti-Gypsyist speech or act.
On that day, you also organize youth trips, so you take young people to Auschwitz-Birkenau. What does the program look like, and how do you prepare the young people for this journey?
Well, this is also something new that we brought. Actually, it was the beginning of the Ternipe initiative. Mm-hmm. Ternipe is a network of youth organizations in Europe. And when we started participating in this Die Cannabis-Star event, we brought also this idea of the resistance, which immediately was received with huge enthusiasm mm-hmm. by the organizers, by the other organizations. Yes, since then, actually, we prepare a group of youngsters from France. We have 2 or 3 meetings, it depends, prior to the trip mm-hmm. to Poland. We exchange with them. We tell them the story of the genocide, of how the anti-Gypsyism took form, which forms it took in the 30s, 40s. And this is very important for the French youngsters who had no access, actually, very, very little access. There is kind of 1 or 2 sentences in a school book about this. So we tell them the story of the internment of those people who were called nomads in that time, acts of resistance in France, those who were deported from the northern France to death camps, the camps of internment in France who were liberated only in June 1946, meaning 1 year after the end of the war, and of course a preparation also to this trip to Poland with this program, which is very rich with historians, but also survivors of that time of the genocide who had been in the camps. And after they return, we try also to keep the contact, and we see that they get inspiration, actually, and they start action in France. Once back, they start some actions for their small community or for the community in general.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And there are concrete examples, like William Acker, for instance, who is one of those young people who was in the last time in Poland. Well, you never come back from such a thing, the same person. You, something changed in you, something changed in him. He was already quite sensitized, but when he saw afterwards an explosion in France in which there has been a huge pollution, and the Romani community, Jean du Voyage, who was living there, nothing was planned for them, he started a huge work of data collection on where are the caravan sites in France, how risky they are for the health.
Mm-hmm.
And very soon, in a few weeks now, I think, he will publish a book about this with all this data.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just to fill in on that, there was an explosion. It was in northern France. It was an oil refinery or chemical refinery. All the farmland around it was extremely polluted afterwards. All of the crops had to be destroyed. They couldn't be used. The farmers that had losses, and the stopping site for the Jean du Voyage are in this chemically infected area. So this is something that is very actual, very real, very present. And I'm looking forward to William Acker's work on this as well.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe just moving on a bit, Saimir, you used the word genocide, and I know, and you know, I know that this is a very accurate, very precise word, and you are also very accurate and precise with the language that you use as a linguist, as an activist, and you avoid the word Holocaust. And I would like to bring that up, and I would like to hear, I think our listeners could benefit from hearing your explanation why you prefer the word genocide and not the word Holocaust. It's important to you, it's important to me also, and it's good to explain this for our listeners, since we're talking about the 16th of May and 1944, I think this is a good point to bring that up.
Yeah.
Well, you have all heard about the professional deformation. We're all deformed by our professions. As I happened to be also a language professor and a lawyer and an activist, I am deformed by all sides. So this is why I am very precise, and I try to be the most precise possible. Actually, the word genocide was coined after the Second World War. It didn't exist before, so everyone knows this. And it is a legal concept precisely defined by an international convention on prevention of genocide. We know precisely what a genocide is. Now, the word Holocaust is first used in the Bible, and in the Judeo-Christian history, tradition, and transmission of knowledge or of instinctive transmission, the Holocaust is the sacrifice by fire for God. Isaac was the survivor of the Holocaust. His father brought him to the mountain to burn him, and then he heard that God talked to him, and we know the story that he didn't kill his son, and that God provided with a sheep for the sacrifice. Mm-hmm. This is what Holocaust is. This story is almost never said. I only heard it, not the story, but this definition of the Holocaust, I heard it only by Mr. Polak, mm-hmm. who is a European member of the European Parliament, who in a speech in the Council of Europe said, we paid the price of having our rights respected because we went through a Holocaust. The Holocaust is the sacrifice. We paid the price of the sacrifice.
Yeah, let me just interject. Mr. Polak is a Roma member of the European Parliament, and he is referring to Roma when he's speaking. But please continue. Yeah.
Yes. So he is sincere enough to... He's sincere and clairvoyant. He sees clearly this and he says it. But most of the people don't. And most of the people think that Holocaust is a genocide, upgraded genocide. Holocaust is something harder than genocide. Holocaust is recognition of Holocaust is being recognized as a real victim, while a victim of a genocide would be, in their mind, a low-cost victim. Mm. So first, it is about victimizations. There is no reason for victimization. Second, it is about inaccuracy, because a Holocaust, the word Holocaust, is purely ideological. It is not a legal term. It has no clear consistency, a clear definition. Holocaust has been used as such. And people think that Holocaust, being recognized victim of the Holocaust, is something higher, while it is not. First, and second, as we know that a Holocaust is a sacrifice to God, this is something awful, actually, but I will say it. When you say that these people was victim of a Holocaust, actually you raise the Nazism to the level of God. You raise Hitler to the level of God, because to whom were sacrificed the millions of people killed in the death camps or in the forests or wherever the Nazis sued them? They were not sacrificed to any divinity. They were sacrificed to the horrible regime that Germany had in that time. So I refuse it.
Yeah.
I refuse it, and I use genocide because genocide is a crime against humanity, which is precisely defined as the intention to eradicate a given population defined by the perpetrator. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I would just like to add, I resisted this argument because as a native English speaker, and as I know how the word Holocaust is used in the U.S., and I know that it was, I never imagined, and you use this argument argument 10 years ago, you said this is a religious word and we need to keep church and state separate. We need to keep this division clear. We don't want to create a hierarchy of victims. And I said, yeah, I think that that's generally understood. I think most people get it. It's not going to happen. I think you're a little bit paranoid, Samir. Maybe I was like, I'm an American and you're a stubborn Francophile and your separation of church and state is different. And the French ideas of how to interpret words is very precise. But then this member of parliament said precisely what you said no one should ever say. And it happened in the parliament of Europe or in Strasbourg or in Brussels, wherever it was, this happened. And ever since then, I am now also 100% on your side because I think we cannot have this confusion. There needs to be a precise separation and there cannot be a hierarchy. Mm. And thank you for explaining that for our listeners. And thank you for convincing me, because while there is also the English, common English language usage of this word might not take into consideration its original definition and how it's used, we have to remember that English is also used by people who don't speak it as their native language. Mm. And it yes. is yeah. used by people who look up words in the dictionary and then they might use the original meaning and add the religious connotations in places where they should not be used at all. So mm-hmm. thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much for this explanation.
Yeah, thank you, Samir, for making this point. I also often heard critique from Romani people to the term Holocaust, especially because it's so much related to the Jewish Holocaust. But I didn't know actually about this original meaning and about the connection to the Bible. So thank you for that. What about the terms Pochaimos and Samudari Pen?
Well, the first question is, why a special name for given genocide? Is that necessary? Mm. I don't think it is. Mm-hmm. I don't think it is necessary. A genocide is a genocide. Whether it targets the Tutsi in Africa or the Jews in Europe or the Tsigoyner in Europe or whomever. So the word Samudari Pen, actually, it's a new word, it's a neologism, but it's a fake neologism because anyone who speaks Romanes would understand it. Mm-hmm. Because it is coined with sa, which means palm, mm-hmm. and mudaripen or murdaripen or mudarimos, which means killing. Actually, it is the killing of all, the all killing, the general killing, the killing of all. It means nothing more, nothing less than genocide. This is when I translate something in Romanes, if I have the word genocide there, including for the speaking about the genocide of Armenians, for instance, I will use the term Samudari Pen, because this is how we say in modern Romani, in elaborate Romani, the word genocide. Mm-hmm. Then the Poraimos and its derivates are really a mistake. Actually, it is a bit like the word Holocaust. Mm. When I studied law, the history of law, and some of the ancient regimes, ancient laws, there was a proverb in Latin, error communis facit ius. The common mistake creates the rule. A mistake circulates and it becomes the rule. This is how the word Holocaust was imposed. Mm-hmm. This is also how the word Poraimos was circulated very much, but actually it is to be left aside. Poraimos in Romani has a sexual meaning, not connotation only, which has nothing to do with the suffering of Romani people during the Second World War. It means defloration. Mm-hmm. It never meant devouring, as some people think. Never. It has never been used as such. Porado, for instance, is an insult. And it is also, if I have to make a link with the resistance, for instance, mm-hmm. some Romani people gave to the police a fake family name, which was Porado. Porado means someone whose orifices have been enlarged. Mm-hmm. This name is in official documents of the time of the persecution of the 40s, 1940s. People who are called Antoine Porado, and we know exactly that they haven't been called this way. This was the name they gave to the police as an ultimate act of resistance. And sometimes these names are also in monuments.
Mm-hmm.
For Aymos, I don't use it. I use it for what it is, but it cannot be. It cannot be used for genocide, whatever the target. As in the same way as Holocaust cannot be, but Holocaust it's even worse because it means that the victims have been sacrificed to God by the fire.
Yeah. Let's jump back to the activities of La Voix des Roms. I would like to know more about the boxing club you are running, or you initiated, the Yak Bari Boxing Club. What is it about?
This is also one of the declinations of our resistance philosophy. It was after the trip in 2014 in Poland with a group of youngsters. We came back, and among us, we started, as among us, there was a former champion of Chinese boxing. He was volunteering in our association, and he's still volunteering, although now he's a bit far. He proposed to start some boxing classes, and we started among us in the association. Then he proposed the same thing for a project for an educative project with children living in shanty towns, in social hotels, in a very difficult situation in the region. Mm-hmm. So this is how it started. We put the name Yag Bari, which means the big fire, and which recalls the idea of warmth, of growth, of resistance, of energy. And this lasted for like 6 years with children, Romani children mostly, but not only. It was a project which transmitted values of the martial arts. Mm-hmm. It was an educative project through the practice of martial arts, but also other extrascolar activities like screening movies, going to the cinema, museums, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And it targeted, let's say, about 100 children in the whole duration.
Wow. You know Oswald Marschall, the German Sinto boxer? He's also running a boxing club, which has the same approach. They're doing training classes, but also helping the children with their homework and doing activities like going to the movies or whatever.
Excellent. And this is a resource, actually, without falling into the trap of the culturalism. It is true that boxing is the sport in which we have many Romani people practicing, and on the contrary of what people think at the first sight, boxing is not about violence. Boxing is about self-control, about respect. So I think that here we have a real excellent resource of of education.
Yeah, and in Germany we also have the icon of Rukeli Trollmann, the famous Sinto and professional boxer who was stripped of his championship title by the Nazis because he had this dancing un-German boxing style.
Yep. Mm.
The German Sinto Johann Rukeli Trollmann, born in 1907, was a successful professional boxer. When the Nazis came to power, they tried to end his career, which was not easy given his worldwide success. The Nazis took away his championship title on flimsy grounds. Trollmann's dancing boxing style was described as un-German. In July 1933, Rukeli Trollmann entered the ring for his last professional fight in protest with bleached hair and white powdered skin. He stood at eye level in front of his opponent, without footwork, without deflecting blows. This was Trollmann's way of caricaturing the German fist fight that was to replace boxing in the future. And it was the end of his career. Labor camps and forced labor followed. Rukeli Trollmann died in 1944 in a sub-camp of the Neuen Gamme concentration camp. Even though book, film and theater projects have made his tragic fate better known, he has still not received the public recognition he deserves given his importance as a sportsman and as a tragic figure in contemporary history.
Yep. His story has been told to all the children who passed by the Yagbari Boxing Club, and not only. He is one of the heroes that we always promote, saying the story, how he resisted. Yeah.
Bill, shall we ask our guest for the virtual gift he brings us?
Yeah, I think it's time for a little bit of a break after all these tough questions. Maybe we let's talk about the gift. Let's have some fun here. So what'd you bring us, Saimir?
It is just a pen.
Uh-huh.
It is a normal pen, but it is written La Voix de Rome on it. This is not to advertise about our organization, but I thought of it because it is about a pen is about writing.
Mm-hmm.
Is this a new pen? Is this part of the current budget? Did we approve this?
Oh, Samia.
And here we recognize the chairman, who is always there to control everything, is correct.
So it is new. It's not something old. It's not something from 2015. It's from like all the stuff that we made for the festival.
This was offered by the company who printed out the visit cards of Jonuts, who is the youngest and the newest member of our team.
Oh, great.
He's the mediator of La Voix de Rome.
All right. Well, I want one of the pens. I want, when am I going to get it?
So one pen for the president, please.
Yeah, we'll make it.
Okay,
we'll
make thank it. You.
That's nice. Thank you.
Actually, I choose this not because of the organization, but because of something that I feel really indispensable. It is not about La Voix de Rome as our organization, but it is about the voice and the mind of the Romani people in its diversity, being leading the way that the pen will write a strategy of our community for itself.
Hmm.
Autonomous thinking and strategic thinking and acting.
Yes, of course. There's never a simple answer. There's always symbolism and several layers of it when we get an answer from Saimir. Okay.
You said before that you didn't speak Romanes in your family. What does the language mean for you personally?
Ah, for me, it means a lot because I learned Romanes when I was 17, 18. I started. And then, well, of course, I perfectioned, I enriched it afterwards. I studied it also. For me, it represents a passport. But I never thought of it as such, actually. A passport is for going abroad and for being recognized.
Mm-hmm.
The Romani language is a passport for being recognized by your mate. And it is something that is valorizing.
Mm.
And of course, as any other language, I will not enter into exaggerated lyricism, but the language is also the vehicle of a culture, of a cosmovision, of everything.
Mm.
And the language in which you think shapes your thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And vice versa.
Yes.
Yes. Symbolically, I will say that the language, Romani language, is a passport, but it is not like a Gajicano passport you go abroad with. It is like a passport you meet your brothers with.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, Romani is spoken and written in different ways, different dialects. Do you have a specific opinion on developing a standardized Romani? You worked with Marcel Courtiad. Does it matter if we have a standard? Do you have an opinion? Are we ready for a standard?
Here is also one point in which our thinking is framed with the mainstream frames.
Yes.
Yeah.
Languages have been standardized for nations which have been defined by a political power on a given territory. We don't have one political power, one uniformized political power, and we don't have any territory that would be ours and in which that political power would exert in our names the sovereignty of ours. So we cannot think in the same terms than Goethe, than François Premier, or whomever who unified languages of people who became nations and states. For me, the language is there. And it is a miracle that we, after 1,000 years of departing from the original lands, and after 700 years of hard European history, really hard European history, the lives of our people have never been easy here in Europe, we still have our language alive. Not all of us speak it, but the language is still there. For me, this is a miracle. If someone can explain it to me in scientific, normal words and thinking, I take it. But I couldn't find any other example like this. Now, standardizing a language is making frames. This is not how we function. Unifying the diversity of our language, this is what we could and what we should do. Actually, our cousins in Spain don't speak Romanes because of the repression that have gone through. But they have some words, they have kept some words. Among the words that they kept one word which all of us who spoke from generation to generation, all of us lost that word.
Oh.
That word is for the trousers.
Uh-huh.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say chorizo.
No, chorizo, you can't call it but chorizo.
Okay.
But the trousers, we say it always in a majority language, we borrow the word. Uh-huh. They kept the word choleva.
Can you say it again?
Choleva.
Choleva.
Choleva. Okay. Yeah. Choleva, which stands for trousers. Mm-hmm. So our efforts should be not of standardizing, on saying this is correct, this is not correct, we have to... No, our efforts should concentrate on gathering all we have in common, the most in common, and in circulating the common content of the language, the common vocabulary, circulating this vocabulary enough so that with the time, the intercomprehension, the understanding between different people from different places is easier and easier. It is already. It still is easy.
Yeah, it's happening. But what about just a standardized alphabet, at least? What do you think about that?
This is also, and all what I said and all what I will say for the alphabet actually is in a decision of the 4th Congress of the International Romani Union, who adopted an alphabet. Two alphabets were proposed back then, one based on the Latin alphabet and the other on the Cyrillic. Mm-hmm. Only the Latin was accepted, which I find a bit... I regret this because many Romani people have the Cyrillic as a reference, but this can change with the time. With a few adaptation for some sounds which have a special behavior in Romani. And it is necessary to have a common code because actually the writing here is the alphabet is the most political question when it comes to linguistics, to linguistic policy. If a Czech speaks to a Macedonian, they will understand each other better than if they write to each other. Because the Macedonian use the Cyrillic alphabet and the Czech use the Latin one. But both are Slavic languages.
Oh, you're speaking about Czechs and Macedonians, not Czech Roma and Macedonian Roma.
No.
Okay.
Not Roma.
Okay.
I'm speaking about the Czech language and Macedonian language or Bulgarian language. So for political reasons, some people choose the Cyrillic, others choose the Latin. Actually, it was for the religious reasons at that time. Mm. The languages are closer in the years than in the eyes.
Yeah. Mm.
So for the Romani too, it has to be a political decision. We don't have this political power, as I said, who will be legitimate or whatever. I don't know what happens currently in Washington as we are recording this.
Wow, yeah.
This is also about legitimacy.
Yeah.
So I have studied with the alphabet which was adopted in 1990 in Warsaw, in this fourth Congress of the International Romani Union. I have chosen it and I use it because it fits to the phonological structure of Romani language, not because of the political authority, which is something that can be subjective. Anyone can think what they want about International Romani Union now and at the time and whatever. But for this decision and the principles of unification in that time, and not standard, but unification of Romani language was discussed in that Congress. And these are the principles that I apply.
I can contribute with a little anecdote about trying to get Romanesque texts proofread. Maybe you remember, Bill, when working on Rom Archive, the digital archive of the Roma, which is published in German, English, and Romanesque, as a customary texts have been translated by Romanesque translators and then proofread by Romanesque, by other Romanesque translators once again, but the editors always completely rewrote the texts, even within the same dialect. So the authors again resisted in turn the editing. So actually, at the end, there was no more proofreading, and we just simply allowed the many different spellings and sense of diversity. So we made the experience: ask three Romanesque translators for a translation, you'd get four different answers at least.
So this is about diversity of mm-hmm. the dialects, which is normal in all languages, but it is also about the powerlessness. Mm-hmm. Because when it comes to the writing, all of us Romani people have a reference, which is the code of the alphabet of the language, of the majority language you have gone to school with.
Mm. Yeah.
Like you guys, like anyone, we're not coming from Mars or from I don't know which planet. So we have been in the same schools as everyone, and we have a reference of the writing for the majority language, and that correspondences that we have learned in the majority language, we use them also for our home language, because we don't have been taught other correspondence for this other language. So it is very difficult for an Albanian, for instance, to write the sound H, because the H does not exist in Albanian. It exists in German, but in German it is written in some way. And in Spanish, in which the sound is slightly different, it is written in another way. Everyone will write with the reference that one have from the majority language.
Mm-hmm.
And this is because we don't have any education, formal education on writing in our language.
Mm. Talking about spelling, our listeners cannot see it, but Rom in La Voix de Rom is written with two R. Why?
Because in Romani language, there are two different sounds mm-hmm. of R. We have R, like Rota, Ruv, Guruv, and we have another R, which can be R. In my dialect, we say Snom Rom, Rom.
Mm-hmm.
Others say Rom, others say Rom. So it is this second R, which is at the beginning of the name of our people, Rom. We say Rom.
Mm-hmm. So it's for the pronunciation, Rom. Actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I see.
New question, new theme. What does it mean for you personally to be a Roma? This is, yes, a big general question. Sorry. But you know, I'm thinking of about a time that, you know, once you said, if there's ever going to be a definition of a Roma, then I'm going to call myself Gypsy, because I don't want to fit into the box that someone else defined. I don't know. Maybe that's, you can talk about something else. It doesn't have to be that. But what is your personal feeling about being Roma? What does it mean to you?
Okay. As you said, it is much easier to say I am a gypsy, because it's easy, and you can define the gypsy, because you define it always according to the image of the gypsy in the particular society. It's not the same when you speak about Rome. As I said, I was, I don't know, 6 or 7 when I discovered that I was a gypsy, and then I discovered very hardly what was to be a Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Why this? Because for being an activist, usually, not all, But usually the activists are people who have had good chances of having a good education, a good social position, and they can get active. Okay, mm-hmm. We don't fit with the gypsy, mm-hmm. and we are not comfortable with the gypsy. The gypsy bothers us, disturbs us. But not everyone has the time or the conditions, the necessary conditions to discover what the Rom is.
Mm.
So for me, I've been clever enough to make one of my masters was about the identity and the identification of some minorities in Europe which are labeled as gypsies. I have never stopped thinking about this, actually, ever since. So I have passed a lot of time thinking about this, and I, for me today, personally, being a Rom is being a part of community which should be at the lead of what society of tomorrow should be.
Hmm.
In terms of what diversity is, in terms of what acceptance of diversity is, in terms of how much I am defined by myself and how much I'm defined by the others, the way they look at me.
And how much I accept the diversity of others as well. Sorry, I'm interjecting.
Exactly. How much I accept the diversity of the others too. How much I respect, how much I tolerate, how much... All these questions, I am convinced our people have found the right answers to all those questions. Why I am convinced of that? Because, as I said, I could not explain otherwise the fact that our people still exist today as such. You cannot survive in a hostile environment, and this is what Europe has been for us and still is for 700 years. You cannot survive without finding the right equilibrium between all these questions. Mm. Who I am, who I should appear, how much I tolerate, how much I take, how much I leave, how much I abandon, how much I am conservative, how much I... all these questions have been answered by our people. Otherwise, I will not be here speaking with you today for about this subject.
Yeah. Yeah, Bill, all our guests are emphasizing the resilience of Romani people, aren't they?
Yeah, resilience and kind of avant-garde, kind of future example for the future, or showing what is possible. Yeah,
resilience and ingenuity, I would say.
Bill, do you agree? Do you feel the same? What means being Roma for you personally?
Oh, I do agree with everything that Saimir just said. Just like last week when you asked me, I agreed with everything that Nico said. and you asked me this question, and I remember I gave a short answer. Mm. And then 20 minutes later or the next day, I thought, oh, I didn't give a good enough answer. Because like Saimir just said now, I think about it all the time. Or let's say not all the time. Very often, I will think about this. And what does this actually mean? And how it has changed for me over time as well. Because, like I said, I think about it over time, but not all the time, because sometimes I feel like, well, I don't want to answer that question. And it's like, for me personally, it's personal. It's my business. I don't need to explain to anybody. I don't need to justify it. I don't need to analyze it. I just feel it, and it feels good most of the time. And sometimes it doesn't feel good, but I think it's because I'm overanalyzing or taking into considerations some kind of external assumptions about what it means, and what it means to be Roma, what it means to be Gypsy, what are these intersections or false intersections, have come about over time.
Mm-hmm.
I do have something. I thought about this because I wanted to give a good answer also, not just to be really, really quick. Because I used to think, having grown up in America, that it wasn't such a big deal, but it was special. So it was just like being Italian American, Vietnamese American, or some other additional label. I used to think that. It's just one that it's not as well known and needs a little bit more effort to understand. But every time I learn something new, and I'm still learning. 30 years after I discovered I was Roma, after my mother told me, after I learned things from my family, I'm still learning new things, and I'm learning, and my idea evolves over time. And it is something personal. I agree with Saimir. I think that we've survived, and we have when we learn to accept what exists and what is true, we can be happy and deal with the rest. So like there, it's not to be completely free and without any form. I mean, things change and evolve over time, but there is an ancrage. You are anchored to something. And when you accept what the reality is, then you can deal with everything else in a much more healthy, happy way. Yeah. That's what I see, because I could give lots of examples of different things that bother me or things that I've learned over time. You know, like we were talking about the gypsies that live in one village and they call themselves gypsies, and they're separate from the gypsies in another country that only call themselves gypsies in another village, but they don't know about each other. So they don't call themselves Roma, or what is Roma? All of these questions of how anthropologists have divided us over time. Yeah. And the word gypsy itself, like, if you would ask me 10, 20 years ago as an American, the same label, I would say, oh, you shouldn't use the word gypsy. You should just use the word Roma. And it's just, one is a bad word and one is a good word. Mm-hmm. Well, no, it's much more complex than that, because you have the concept of the gypsy, as Saimir said, the people who are perceived as gypsies. There is this mythological concept, this creation over time, and these stereotypes that were developed, you know, in the 19th century, after centuries of anti-gypsyism. And then you see how much has that changed and been influenced by anti-gypsyism. How do we see ourselves as a result of images that were created by the majority? Is that really our culture or not? And This has taken me years and years and years of analysis and looking at it and thinking and reading and learning. And I'm fascinated by it. But at the same time, I resent that I have to put so much effort into it.
Yeah, like, I see.
No, who learns at school that they're American or they're French or they're German? I had to go through a lot of extra effort. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing this. It's a rich culture, many different cultures that have some common threads and some less common. And for me, it's, yeah, it depends what day you ask me if I like it or not. But overall, I feel, yeah, I think that there is something that is worth learning and researching for the majority. And I think that this sometimes these questions, anti-gypsyism is a problem of the majority. It's not our problem to solve. Absolutely. Anti-Semitism isn't a problem for Jews to solve. It's a problem for the majority. Mm-hmm. So I sometimes just think, well, I am who I am and I don't have to explain anything.
Yeah, I absolutely understand. But I will ask you again and again. Because
yes, of course, please.
You always no give problem. other answers, and it's always very interesting because it also reflects that it's about a feeling towards being Roma.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
As a little warm-up for the last part of our conversation, we prepared another little game. Saimir, we're going to read some terms to you, and you answer very spontaneously, just with one word or a very short sentence, okay? You ready?
Okay.
Community.
Togetherness. Vision.
Nature.
Life.
Youth.
Hope.
Family.
Warm.
Home.
The same warm.
Yesterday.
Lesson.
Tomorrow.
Sun.
Hope.
I'm sorry, but luxury.
Language.
Brain.
Europe.
Schizophrenia.
Politics.
Politics. How to say? Femme maltraitée.
Okay. Dilino.
Oh, fun.
Bachtalo.
Example.
Gajo.
It is complicated.
Okay. Anti-gypsyism.
Cement.
Cement. Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay.
It's the cement of the many European nations.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. That's the end of our little game. Dilno is the Anglo-Romani word for fool or foolish. Dilino is the Central European version of the same word. It's the diminutive of the word dilo. This is originally an adjective, but can be used as a noun. And in both cases, even people who don't know Romani very well will often know this word. Buc is the Anglo-Romani word for luck. Its Central European version, bacht, means luck or happiness. Bachtalo is the adjective, means happy or lucky. It's typically used in a greeting, Teo ves bachtalo, may you be happy and lucky. Gorgio is the Anglo-Romani word for a non-Romani person. In Central European Romani, the word is gajo. In its original sense, it's not pejorative. Depending on context and tone of voice, it can be pejorative, and people not familiar with the Romani language often presume this negative meaning.
Sami, are you an optimist or a pessimist?
Optimism and pessimism are some things that I said it's a luxury, actually, like hope also. I keep in the move. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Do you think this current crisis or the situation we're in right now, could this be a starting point for change?
Any crisis is a chance for a change. Mm. I'm not sure that this crisis will be the one that will push people to make the needed change.
Mm. Do you think we talk about Roma as role models with all our guests? So what the question is always, what can the majority society learn from Roma communities? We heard a lot. Daniel Baker said that Roma are considered bohemians as avant-garde and that this majority society should admire them for their unconventional approaches, their resilience. Ethel Brooks was emphasizing family, solidarity, responsibility. Jeliko Jovanovic actually put it in a nutshell and said, we find a way out where everybody else just sees a dead end. What would you say could the majority societies learn from Roma communities? And I use the plural.
I invite, really, all the majority communities not to learn anything by us, about us, but to start learning from us about themselves. Mm-hmm. Because actually, the gypsy is what the majority societies have created as being the absolute other that they, the majority, should never become. And they should never be. This is what the majority should, the way that in which the majority should learn from us. It is not about Bohemia or whatever, the freedom or whatever. All these things are actually often exaggerated. And always it is like the clown who makes people laugh, but the clowns are always very unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
So the majority has its own interest, actually. It is in its own interest to learn from us what the majority is, what they are, and how much our image as gypsy make them comfortable.
Mm.
Because it is a fake comfort also, very often.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting answer. Thank you.
Yeah, very interesting. So, Samia, what is your utopia, your dream for Europe? Or do you have a special Romatopia for a local Roma community?
Well, when the majority will be aware enough about what is fake in its comfort, then the utopia can start. Because Europe is a construction, Europe as we think of it today, at least, the European Union and all this. This is a construction. It has been put in place for the nation states not to make war anymore here because they made two of them and they were considerable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Europe can be also something else. Europe existed before European Union. It will exist. It exists after the United Kingdom left mm-hmm. European Union. It will exist even if others leave this political construction. There was hope in the 90s for the Europe to become really the home of all Europeans. It is not yet. And we are fighting also for the rights of the migrants, many of us, other continents, but actually Europe is not enough home for those who are here for centuries. This is about politics. And as I said, when you asked me what I think, what the word politics make me think, and I said femme maltraitée.
Yeah.
Politics is the most noble, the most noble function that a human can have, making politics. It has become the thing so corrupted. So, utopia, I'm sorry, I don't have a big dream like Martin Luther King had, but times are not the same. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
For me, today, things are going so much in the wrong direction that I think a little stabilization already will be a good thing.
Yeah, there you're right. Sami, we're going to close this conversation, this very interesting conversation, with one last game. If you could ask one question on all radio, TV and print media in Europe for one day, what would it be? What question would you ask?
Okay, tough, really tough. Have you ever thought about what you can do for the world to change and for your life to be better?
Good.
Okay. Thank you very much, Samir.
Thank you so much. Thank it was very, you. Very, very interesting. I learned a lot.
Thank you very much.
And I hope to see you soon.
Thank you and see you soon.
Have a good day. Say yeah. Hello to Mirabella. Okay.
Bye.
Thanks. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Romatopia is supported by the Federal Agency for Civic Education and the Council of Europe Roma and Travelers team. Idea and concept, Isabel Rabe. Romatopia is hosted and edited by Isabel Rabe and William Biela and directed by Katja Lehmann. Sound design by Selamet and Kefait Prizreni. Cover motif by Daniel Baker. Production, Media Bricks Berlin 2020.